Hello, this is Judy with the Herald and Review dated February 13th, 2017. And today we'll begin reading on the front page with the article headlined Plotting Decatur Library Future. Library seeks broader appeal within Decatur. Decatur. With four homeschool children, Jody Haskins appreciates the resources the Decatur Public Library has to offer her family. They particularly enjoy what is offered in the children's department, Haskins said. Yet as her children get older, Haskins said the reasons for why they use the library are changing. By talking with the librarians, Haskins is able to discover new resources that can aid in teaching her children. We have come to value the library, Haskins says. It offers some free online classes, which I never would have known about if a librarian didn't tell us about. With the number of books that are needed for assignments, Haskins said they would never be able to buy anything that is needed from a store. The Haskins are an example of what library officials are taking under consideration as they finish gathering public input for their strategic planning process. Their goal is to set a path for the future direction of the library in order to provide needed resources for as many members of the community as possible. As they do, they must weigh the ways in which residents are now assessing information against other purposes, such as providing spaces for groups and members of the community to meet. Libraries are special places for the community, said Stu Wilson, who works with Library Strategies Consulting Group based in St. Paul, Minnesota. They are so much more than books. It needs to be something that makes Decatur a better place to live. Specifically, those participating in a recent community survey and strategic planning retreat suggested ways in which the library can appear more inviting for a broader range of community members. The survey received 1,264 responses, all of which Wilson said are helpful in gaining a better understanding of how the library is used by community members. Among the suggestions were improving the parking lot and opening an entrance on the second floor to more easily capture pedestrian traffic from the downtown business district and Central Park. The biggest hurdle to overcome before implementing such suggestions would be cost, City Librarian Rick Meyer said. Library Board President John Phillips said the goal is for the building to be open as much as possible, but it has limitations such as the second floor not being built to support a heavy load of books. We have limits to what we can do here, Phillips said. We want to be available for people to come use as it's a tremendous source for the community. About 89% of the library's funding comes from property taxes, 10% from the state, and 1% from donations through organizations such as the Friends of the Library, Meyer said. The library has an annual operating budget of $3.5 million, as Meyer has led efforts to control costs while faced with declining revenue. Its budget was $4.5 million about 5 years ago before changes occurred, including it now operating as a City of Decatur agency. About 40,000 library cards have been issued, representing nearly 55% of Decatur's population of 73,254, Meyer said. He said it offers 300 programs a year with 376,000 items loaned out, along with 47,000 others that are borrowed from other libraries. Continuing with the article, Worker Pay Issue to Heat Up This Week, it's by Kiana Cepeda Miller. Springfield. The question of whether to continue paying government workers during the Illinois budget stalemate will surface again this week. A court will take up the state attorney general's motion to halt payments, and lawmakers will consider a threat by Governor Bruce Rauner to veto one of two proposals to keep them going. A judge in St. Clair County on Thursday is scheduled to hear Attorney General Lisa Madigan's request to end paychecks until the state breaks its nearly two-year budget gridlock. She is asking the judge to reverse a previous court order requiring Illinois to pay state employees even in the absence of a budget, arguing that stopping pay is constitutional and will hasten a budget agreement. House Democrats and Republicans each say they agree that paychecks should continue and have launched competing legislation as a precaution to avoid a government shutdown if Madigan's motion succeeds. But Rauner on Thursday threatened to veto the Democrats' plan, which he said was only temporary. On the other hand, the Republican proposed to keep the payments going longer is unlikely to be approved by the Democrat-controlled legislature. In a video sent to state workers, Rauner on Thursday repeated his refrain that Madigan, the daughter of longtime Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan, is trying to shut down the government. He condemned the Democratic proposal, which would appropriate funds to state agencies to continue paying employees through the end of the fiscal year on June 30, calling it a crisis shutdown that would help Democrats pass a tax increase. Speaker Madigan's spokesman, Steve Brown, said Friday that the governor's response is incomprehensible because the original version of the rival Republican proposal would have guaranteed state employee pay through the same date. An amended Republican plan would keep the paychecks going indefinitely. The Democrat bill's sponsor, Representative Sue Scherner of Decatur, issued a statement arguing that her bill was intended to prevent a government shutdown, but her statement also referred to a comment the governor made when he was campaigning for office suggesting that a government shutdown might be necessary to get Illinois functioning properly again. The text of the Republican measure would also put the governor's office and state agencies in charge of deciding how much money employees receive. This is not the time to give the governor a blank check and say, "Do we want?" Scherer said Friday. Attorney General Madigan filed her motion in January to stop the $400 million a month payroll, arguing the state constitution stipulates that money should not be spent unless lawmakers have passed legislation to okay it. The bills are HB 2803 and HB 1798. Another article titled "Immigration Raids Spark Fear in U.S." by Claire Calofaro. Pastor Fred Morris looked over his congregation Sunday as news ricocheted around the world that American authorities were rounding up immigrants in an enforcement surge that President Donald Trump promised on the campaign trail. Parishioners did not smile, as on any other Sunday morning. Their eyes darted around the room. They stared down at their feet. Others didn't attend at all. There is a dreadful sense of fear. It's more than palpable. It's radiating. People are terrified, said Morris, whose United Methodist mission is in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood of Los Angeles. They were just sitting there in stunned silence. For days, fear and confusion have gripped immigrant communities across the nation after word spread that the federal agents were rounding up hundreds of immigrants in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, New York, California, Illinois, and Texas. The scope of the operation remained unclear on Sunday. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency said the efforts were routine and no different than the targeted arrests carried out under former President Barack Obama. But Trump took to Twitter to claim credit. "The crackdown on illegal criminals is merely the keeping of my campaign promise," he wrote early Sunday. "Gang members, drug dealers, and others are being removed." On the Sunday morning talk shows, the president's representatives said the enforcement was a result of Trump's policies. White House policy advisor Stephen Miller told the Fox News Sunday that the administration had taken new and greater steps to remove criminal aliens who pose a threat to public safety. Among those arrested in the Carolinas and Georgia, more than 150 more were rounded up in and around Los Angeles, and 40 were arrested in New York City and surrounding areas, Customs confirmed. A decade ago, immigration officers searching for specific individuals would often arrest others encountered along the way, a practice that drew criticism from advocates. Under the Obama administration, agents focused more narrowly on specific individuals. Customs now appear to be reverting back to old politics or old policies. Immigrants' rights groups cite the case of Manuel Mosquita, a 50-year-old house painter, as an example of how they believe customs agents in the new administration are going too far. During last week's enforcement operation, customs agents showed up at Mosquita's home looking for someone else. While there, they inquired about Mosquita, learned he was here illegally, and put him on a bus to Mexico. Carla Navarrete, a lawyer from the advocacy group CHIRLA, said she sought to stop Mosquito from being placed on the bus and was told by customs that things had changed. She said another lawyer filed a federal court papers and got a judge to stop the deportation. The bus turned around and Mosquita is now jailed in Southern California, waiting to learn his fate. Agents who went to a Virginia apartment Thursday looking for a wanted man picked up everyone else in the apartment too, except for one woman with a baby in her arms, said Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, a legal director for Legal Aid Justice Center's Immigrant Advocacy Program in Northern Virginia. For supporters of Trump's immigration policies, the new and broader approach was welcome news. The main thing is to send the message that the immigration laws are actually being enforced again. That in itself is an important message that's got to be sent, said Mark Krikorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that advocates for tighter controls on immigration. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly said the agency is simply enforcing federal law. But immigration advocates said many immigrants are afraid to send their children to school and afraid to go to church or work or the hospital. Panicked rumors spread as quickly as the truth. Every time so much as a white guy with a clipboard is walking around, everyone runs into their apartments and locks the doors, he said. One case that sowed widespread fear was that of Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes, a mother of two in Phoenix, who was arrested nearly a decade ago for using a false ID to get a job as a janitor. She pleaded guilty to a felony charge, but the government declined to deport her. On Wednesday, she showed up at the customs building in Phoenix for a scheduled check-in with immigration officers and was deported to Mexico. Advocates and immigration attorney across the country scrambled to hold seminars and conference calls teaching people their rights. At his Sunday morning service, Morris handed out a double-sided sheet listing congregants' civil rights. The first read, "Don't open your door. He is planning a community meeting for tonight with lawyers, immigration advocates, and counsels from Mexico, El Salvador, and Guatemala. He has another plan, too. He started organizing a phone chain. If he hears about a raid on a home in his community, he will call five people who will call five people, and so on. They will all show up and stand on the sidewalk and chant, 'ICE, go home.' He hopes public shaming will prove to be a deterrent. The only weapon we have is solidarity," he said. They are deporting people who may be documented, but they do not have rights under our laws. Under recreation, an article titled Recalling When Softball Ruled in Post-World War II Decatur by Tony Reed. Decatur, the boys of summer never fade to old age while cradled in the 92-year-old hands of Jack Troche. He's looking through glossary photographs of the Decatur baseball and softball teams he played for from about 1944 through to the early 1950s. Rows of smiling young men in moments of time captured forever in black and white amber, the lads who will never be old. Troche likes to reminisce and hopes to remind a few others old enough to remember when Decatur sports scene was like back then. The blue-collar landscape was littered with factories, civilian and weaponized, and many of them sported ball teams that played in fiercely competitive leagues. The fact that Troche was still able to be around to play at all during the World War II years hung on a draft board decision that he was more valuable out of a military uniform. He was a young foreman in a Decatur war factory that was doing work so secret the employees had no idea what they were building. What he made turned out to be part of the atomic bomb, Troche says, and we didn't know until they dropped the second one, Japanese city of Nagasaki, August 9, 1945, what we had been a part of. And so there he was, helping to usher in the atomic age on one hand and being able to play some competitive ball on the other. He played his heart out for several teams, but recalls particularly many outings for teams sponsored by the Hipsters, Mobile Gas, and Evie's Tavern. A catcher who was small, 5'8", and very fast with a good throwing arm, Troche and his fellow boys of summer won their share of championships in what was now known as the Industrial League. A lot of times at the All-Star Game or our playoff games, they would estimate the crowds at 5,000, he says with a fond smile. They would stretch out clear around the outfield. How good was the young man whose knowing smile beams out of those old team shots? He recalls being approached around 1946 by a talent scout who had watched his team play a doubleheader and promptly offered a baseball contract with the then New York Giants. They wanted to plant him in their farm system in Texas to see what he might grow into. But they struck out because Troche, who had a good day job, turned them down. Even the big baseball players in the big leagues didn't make much money back then. It wasn't like it is today, he explains. I didn't want to go down there for $50 a month and give up my good job. Occasionally, however, when the sense of nostalgia hits him just right, he'll think back and wonder, what if he hadn't said no and hadn't walked away on that fateful day? Sometimes I wish I had tried, he said. I had a lot of confidence back then and a lot of desire. Pamela Cummings, the oldest of his three daughters, says her father might indeed have hit one out of the park if he had been given a baseball to try as a career. I'm too young to remember, but from what I understand, he was pretty good, says Cummings, 67. But I also know he's had a really good life anyway, and he's always happy. My dad is a very good guy. Now the man who is a grandfather 8 times over and a great-grandfather of 16 bends to tidy up his boys of summer pictures and counts his blessings on the looming scoreboard of life. I've had a lot of fun, and I've no regrets, he says, and I've got a really nice family. You know, that is what it's all about. From local news, new business data source, subtitle Area Business Leaders Urge to Seek Out Information by Chris Lusvardi. Decatur. The Millikan-Decatur Executive Association will hold an event to inform area business leaders about a new tool they can use to look for information. The Demographics Now workshop will be Thursday, February 23rd at the Barnes Citizens Building, 236-250 North Water Street. Networking will be from 7 to 7:30 a.m., followed by breakfast from 7:30 to 8 a.m., a program from 8 to 9 a.m., and a workshop from 9 to 11 a.m. The database provides information about the demographics and spending habits of residents in a certain area. Through Decatur, Mount Zion, and Forsyth Public Libraries. Our goal is to inform our network of leaders of information on our community to evaluate trends of consumers, said Rhoda Luther, MDEA Chair. While every data point is not available, we hope it will provide a basis for information to drive further research on entrepreneurship. Luther said the database is part of the wealth of information the local libraries provide. Our owners and executives don't automatically think of the library when making business plans, Luther said. Based on some of this data, they should. The group is composed of area executives who Luther said are the business leaders of the community. They are the ones who are the analysts, risk takers, and knowledge seekers of the area. So she said it's important for them to know where to look for the best information, especially when it's available for free. Other partners in Demographics Now include the Economic Development Corporation of Decatur and Macon County, City of Decatur, Greater Decatur, Chamber of Commerce, Millikan University, Richland Community College, Village of Mount Zion Chamber of Commerce, and Mount Zion Economic Development Office. For more information on the event, contact Bethany Witherholt by email or Bwetherholt at millikan.edu or call 217-424-6296. Continuing with local news, neighbor steps in to help couple escape blaze. Decatur. Neighbors came to the rescue Sunday afternoon when fire caused severe damage to a Decatur home. Jean and Bernice Bohannon, a couple in their 80s, were struggling to get clear as flames ripped through the rear of their home at 18 4th Drive around 2:18 p.m. Their neighbor came from across the street, Wanda Nelson, saw them and, accompanied by her own mother, rushed over to assist. They were coming out real slow and we wanted to hurry up and get them away from there because we were worried something would blow up, said Nelson. Jean Bohannon used a walker to get around, and Nelson said she knew they would need help to get clear. There were thick black smoke, and those flames were just a poppin', the couple shaken up. The Bohannons sat in Nelson's yard, huddled under borrowed blankets, and while they have insurance, their house was left uninhabitable. The American Red Cross was assisting them with emergency accommodation. Damage was estimated at $14,000 to the building and a garage and another $2,500 to a car in the garage. Nelson described the couple as a real sweet couple and said she checks on them regularly, drops in to pray with them, and takes them occasionally to meals. I just got a heart for elderly people, she added. Decatur Fire Department Battalion Chief Todd McKenzie said it took fire crews about 10 minutes to knock down the blaze. He said it appeared to start at the rear porch area of the one-story house and had spread into the structure, causing severe damage as well as badly burning a garage and the car inside it. Our big thing was to make sure it didn't extend into the house any further, and to also make sure it didn't reach any of the houses on either side, added McKenzie. He said the cause of the fire was under investigation. The Bohannon's daughter, Gina Bohannon, said her parents had no idea how the blaze started and were now left with little more than the clothes they stood up with. The family would welcome donations of male clothes in 4X big and tall and female clothes in size 1X and 2X. They also need shoes in sizes 14X extra wide for her father and 5.5 to 6 for her mom plus winter coats. If you can help, call 520-0463. Another article entitled A3 Briefs for Monday. Forsyth, incidents link sought. Police are working on the theory that the suspects who kicked in a door to a Forsyth home garage Sunday evening might also be responsible for a spat of prank doorbell ringing in the same neighborhood. The Macon County Sheriff's Office had received reports of the doorbell ringing about 11:30 p.m. Saturday involving two teenage suspects who rang bells in the Loma Drive area before running off. At 8 p.m. Sunday, deputies responded to the kicked-in door, this time at an address in the 300 block of Loma Drive. The homeowner was still checking Sunday night to figure out if anything had been taken. Lieutenant Jamie Belcher said it seems a good possibility the same suspects are involved in all the accidents. Anyone with the information is asked to call 217-424-1319. EIU Spring Concert from Charleston. Eastern Illinois University Oratorio Society is invited singers to be part of EIU's annual spring concert. Rehearsals will begin at 1 p.m. Wednesday, February 15, in Corral Jazz Rehearsal Room 1360 in the Dona Fine Arts Center. The spring concert Sunday, April 23rd, will include selections from the Baroque, classical, and romantic periods in the program, A Journey Through Time. Students, faculty, and members of the community are welcome to register and to bring a friend. For directions or special accommodations, contact the Duda Fine Arts Center at 217-581-3110 or doudnatix at eiu.edu. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Review and Herald dated February 13th, 2017. Please stay tuned.